middle grade strange creatures and fantastic voyages. Thank you so much for coming today. So happy to see you all, these very talented authors here. I'm going to introduce each author individually, and then they'll speak about their work. And then we'll have a brief moderated discussion, about 15 minutes, and then we'll entertain questions from the audience. So be thinking about what sorts of questions you'd like to ask, and we'll get started. Let's start with Kate Milford, the author of The Left-Handed Fate. Can you begin and talk about your book for us?
Sure. Hi, everybody, and thank you for coming out today. This is Left-Handed Fate, and I'm Kate Milford. This is my sixth novel for young readers. And The Left-Handed Fate, I've been really excited for this book. This book has been about, this has certainly been the longest one in the writing. It takes place during the really exciting, epically awesome War of 1812, which I know you're all really excited about because who isn't, in fact, inspired every time we think of the War of 1812? I can tell you what I knew about it before I started writing this book. I knew that a dude wrote a poem at Fort McHenry because I'm originally from Annapolis, and we learned that much in school. And I knew that Washington got burned and Dolly Madison saved a painting. And I think I vaguely knew that we fought against the British because I guess that much got through to me in third grade or whenever it was. What I didn't know was that we lost that war. It was, I think, a war that made a lot of sense for us to declare, but even though we maybe started out with a lot of honor on our side, as the war progressed, our behavior got progressively worse until we were obliged to be trounced by Canada. And if you ever want to be really entertained, say, as I did once in front of a bunch of Canadians, I didn't know much about this war. We don't get taught it very much in school. And then the Canadians were like, what are you talking about? Because it's a big deal there, because we tried to invade Canada because that seemed like a good idea. This is how crazy the War of 1812 got, and they trounced us. Another really cool thing about the War of 1812 is there was a section that took place on the Great Lakes, and one of our officers got knocked out by someone else's flying decapitated head. So, I mean, after that, what else can I tell you to make you read this book? The decapitated head actually isn't in there, but I'm saving that for the next book. But basically, so Left-Handed Fate takes place during the War of 1812, and there are several characters. So there's an American midshipman who is 12. There is a British privateer's daughter who is about 13. There is a natural philosopher who's about 14, and he's also British. And the two British characters, he's hired this privateer in order to try and find the pieces to build this arcane weapon that he believes will be the most powerful weapon ever created that will be powerful enough to stop wars forever. And the other thing about the War of 1812 is it was taking place at the same time as about the Napoleonic Wars, and that's one of the reasons we wound up in this war, because Britain was so busy fighting Napoleon and was spending all of their sailors that it caused them to have to actually stop our ships and anyway, it was a mess, but Napoleon was really the big deal at that point. And so the British characters really want to end the wars with Napoleon, figuring that'll end all these other wars, and then maybe we won't have any more wars going forward because this weapon is just going to be so epic. And I don't know about you, but I have gotten a little bit, started thinking a little bit of weapons in terms of, like, it's easy to think they're going to stop things, but really maybe that's not the best way to try and end wars. So that's one of the challenges that our protagonists have, is they're after this big weapon, but is that really going to help? And then, of course, their ship, this fantastic privateer, gets taken by the Americans and put under the command of this American midshipman who is literally the most useless person on his own ship, which is why he's put in charge of this one, because they're just going to send it back into port. And this poor 12-year-old kid, things just get worse and worse and worse. So we've got people on both sides, and this fantastic weapon, and the French, and oh, there's also this ship crewed by men in black that maybe might not be totally human. And so all of these things are going on, and that's basically Left-Handed Fate. And possibly I will read you a paragraph of it. How much time do I have left? 2 minutes? All right, so I'm going to read you the first paragraph. So basically, it's crazy wars, big weapon, British, English, a 12-year-old midshipman, which, by the way, that was when they thought the best time for you to start at sea in our Navy at that point was, between the ages of 12 and 18. So this is chapter one. Baltimore was a beautiful, twinkling, probably hostile collection of lights up ahead, half hidden by two sheltering arms of land and one massive fortress. The topsail schooner, Left-Handed Fate, slid like an elegant knife through the water, trying as hard as ever she could not to look like a British privateer as she passed under the guns of Fort McHenry. The three youngest passengers stood at the port rail, leaning progressively farther out over the water in order to get a view unobstructed by someone else's head, until the tallest, a young man in spectacles and a blue velvet coat, shoved the leather portfolio he was holding into the hands of the girl in the middle, pivoted abruptly, and vomited over the side. "Is Max all right?" asked the smallest, a child with Chinese features, leaning around the girl to give the older boy the briefest of looks. "He's just committing his supper to the sea." After that, other than handing the portfolio back once the boy called Max had composed himself, Lucy Bluecrown ignored them both. Her eyes were on the fortress, and not all the vomiting landlubbers in the world were going to distract her from the hornet's nest they were sailing into. "But there isn't even any sea running," the small boy protested. "The river's calm as glass." "Since when does he need a reason?" Lucy muttered. "I'm right here," Max said with wounded dignity, "and I'm not seasick, Lau." "Nerves, then," Lau said sympathetically, patting his arm. "I'd be an idiot not to be nervous," Max retorted. "Enough," Lucy said abruptly. The night was far too clear for this sort of adventure. You wanted dirty weather, clouds, mist, a good fierce soaking storm for sneaking in and out of unfriendly ports. But the weather hadn't chosen to cooperate, so here they were, the Fate and all the souls aboard her, waltzing toward the harbor of Fells Point as if it were the most natural thing in the world. And from there, things go really, really horribly wrong, as they do. And that's the Left-Handed Fate. And maybe I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, why don't we hear from Elise Broach, author of The Wolf Keepers, next.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, in the back? It's really fun to be here with this wonderful panel. I think my book is a little different from the other two because it's not a fantasy. It is realistic fiction, but it is based on a real historical mystery. And if any of you have read any of my other books, you know that I love this idea of mysteries that continue to be puzzles that we haven't yet been able to solve. So in this book, the real historical mystery is the mystery of John Muir's lost cabin. Most of you know who John Muir is, I hope. He's a very famous preservationist who was so crucial to saving and protecting the Grand Canyon and Yosemite National Park. Yosemite is the setting of this book, and other wild places. And my first exposure to John Muir was when we moved, when I was 14, to Martinez, near outside Martinez, California, which is in the East Bay, and his home is there and preserved as a museum. So I was 14 years old. We had lived all over the place because my dad worked for General Electric, and we landed in California, which is still where my parents live, and we went to John Muir's house, we went to Yosemite. You know, I saw Yosemite for the first time as a teenager, and I was just blown away by the physical scale of the landscape and how beautiful it was. And so I got interested in John Muir. I did some research on him in high school. I went on to college and graduate school. And in graduate school, in a PhD program, I studied Western history and environmental history. So John Muir was a big focus of environmental history, obviously. And that sort of led, when I started to write this book, I was really thinking of ways that I could tell a story about our relationship to nature and engage young readers and hopefully weave John Muir into it. So the historical mystery part of this is that John Muir lived in Yosemite in the 1800s. He built a cabin there, and he entertained many famous visitors, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Teddy Roosevelt, Asa Gray, who's a botanist. He had them over to his cabin. They stayed there for several weeks. But the cabin itself has never been found. There are different theories about where it was located. It would probably be long since dilapidated and returned to the earth by now. But people have been very curious about it, and there was this legend of John Muir's lost cabin. So a lot of the early visitors to Yosemite would tramp through the woods trying to find it. And John Muir himself knew about the legend, so he wrote about it. He said, you know, everyone's looking for my cabin. So I thought it would be a fun thing to have as part of my mystery that these two kids are trying to find John Muir's lost cabin in Yosemite. And I thought Yosemite would just be a really fun place for an adventure. I think we all made choices about settings that were really important to the kind of adventurous, dangerous plot we could unfold. And in my book, Yosemite is just such a great place for that because there are cliffs and waterfalls and rushing rivers, and in my case, wolves in Yosemite that the two main characters are both trying to protect and fleeing from at different points in the story. So the main character of this book is a girl named Lizzie Durango, who is the daughter of the head zookeeper at a fictional zoo. It's called the John Muir Wildlife Park in California. It's set in the foothills of the Sierras. And she's grown up all her life at the zoo. So bottle feeding, you know, baby llamas and handling snakes and just experiencing the zoo in a very different way than most people do. She's always behind the scenes, which I was intrigued by because I love animals and I love the idea of, you know, having that kind of different, closer connection to animals. So she's grown up at the zoo, and in the book, the zoo is both this fantastical place and also a problematic place, as zoos are. My daughter actually worked at the Beardsley Zoo in Connecticut over the summer, and she was saying there are three kinds of visitors to the zoo, and the first kind are the people who are sort of like probably most of us, where, you know, we have concerns about animals. One of the reasons we might support zoos is to protect and conserve animals, but we understand the limits of what a zoo does and is, so they just sort of come to the zoo, and if the animals are sleeping or out in the back of their cages or whatever, people don't bother them. The second kind of visitor are people who really don't like zoos and are very alarmed that animals are being kept in cages. And Gracie said over the summer, they would say, well, is it getting enough exercise? You know, how is it eating? You know, what's it? And ask all these very concerned questions about the animals' lives. And she said the third kind of visitors are the people who have paid their money and they want to see the animals. And she said they would come in and they'd say, I was here 2 hours ago. That ocelot was in the back of the cage. Can't you shoo it down closer to the... And Gracie would be like, try not to stress out the animals. So that was kind of interesting to me, too, this idea of how people interact with nature. In the book, Lizzie befriends a boy who is a runaway who has been hiding out at the zoo. So the behind-the-scenes experience Lizzie has in the book is quite different from Tyler Briggs, the runaway from foster care, who's been living at the zoo and seeing strange things happening at night. Much of my time here. And he and Lizzie together start unraveling this mystery of what is happening to the wolf pack at the zoo. And this ends up taking them through this kind of circuitous route into Yosemite, into the wilds of Yosemite, on the path of the wolves, and experiencing all sorts of adventures there while they also look for John Muir's lost cabin. I'm trying to think what else I can tell you about the story. It started for me, as I said, I wanted to write about this idea of the wild and our relationship to the wild, but I also wanted to write about the idea of home and how home can be, you know, someplace familiar to you. It can be your place of origin. It can be your idea of safety or community, but it could also be a place that you choose. It doesn't have to be a place that you're from. And in this story, because one of the characters really doesn't have a home, he's, you know, been passed around in various foster care situations, the idea of choosing your own home and forming your own family is a really powerful one. And I liked thinking about that in terms of the wolves, too, in the story, who have been just extricated from their natural realm and put in the zoo, but then in Yosemite, they're basically returning to the wild and forming their own kind of family there. And there's a great quote from John Muir that opens the book that I'll read to you guys, because I think it works with both the idea of the wild and the idea of home. He said, this is from one of his journals, from his record of his travels in the Sierra Mountains. He said, I only went out for a walk and finally concluded to stay out till sundown, for going out, I found, was really going in. And that, for him, is about the idea that nature becomes a way to better know the true self and the true experience of your life and understanding of that. So I hope for my characters, Yosemite is that kind of journey for them. It's a way of going out into nature to understand more about themselves and their own relationships. So I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. It's a brilliant book. And last we have Jennifer Weiner, author of The Littlest Bigfoot. Jennifer?
Hi, I'm delighted to be here. This is my first book for children. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yes, I pimp the product. What happened with this, for many, many years, my publisher had been asking me to write young adult fiction. And I would always tell them that somebody already wrote a book called You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah. And I'm like, well, my title's been taken. I can't do young adult. Like, that's the book I'd write, and I can't do it. What happened was this. I have two daughters, and my daughter Phoebe, my little one, was 6 years old and became obsessed with Bigfoots. There's a show on, I think it's the Discovery Channel, called Finding Bigfoot. I don't know if any of you guys have seen it. But Phoebe was obsessed with this show. And there were three Bigfoot hunters. One was this very skeptical scientist, and one was this sort of true believer folklorist, and one was this anthropologist who was kind of in the middle. And they would go around the world and hunt for Bigfoot. They would, you know, they would go to a place where there had been sightings or strange noises or tracks or, you know, somebody had seen something when they were camping. And I would tease Phoebe. I would she'd be watching it, and I'd be like, "Did they find Bigfoot yet?" And she'd say, "No." And I'd say, "I didn't think so. You know how?" And she'd say, "No." And I'd say, "Because there's three episodes left. And if they found Bigfoot now, there'd be no more episodes." We started talking, me and my daughters, about Bigfoots and other hidden creatures, and what if they were real? What if there were actual Yetis, and what if there were actual vampires, and what if the abominable snowman and the Loch Ness Monster existed? What would they do, and how would they interact with our world? Like, would they try to be online? Would they sign up for Amazon? Would they want free shipping? Would they sell their stuff on Etsy? And we came up with this idea that, like, every summer, all the hidden creatures would get together for, like, a convention. They'd, like, shack up at some dilapidated resort and have, like, a full program of activities. And we got as far as drawing up the schedule. It'd be like, you know, 8 a.m. continental breakfast, 9 o'clock lecture, hiding from humans, 10:15 Zumba. and it was this sort of whole thing. But the Bigfoots were what really captivated me. And I started to think about some of the classic children's stories, Charles Dickens and Roald Dahl and J.K. Rowling, and the idea of kids who are orphans or kids who are outcasts or kids who can't find a place in the world. So I thought about two girls, one of them a human and one of them a Bigfoot. And the human girl is big and clumsy and has this head of unmanageable hair. She's been kicked out of 7 different schools because she breaks things and doesn't get along with people. She's never had a friend in her whole entire life. She lives in New York City, and at the start of the book, her parents have decided to send her to a place called the Experimental Center for Love and Learning in upstate New York. Not so loosely based on a camp that I sent my daughter to last summer. I won't tell you the name of it, but this camp was actually in the newspaper because they banned body talk, okay? You could not give a compliment. You couldn't say to somebody, "Hey, your hair looks really nice today." Because what if the next day you didn't say that and they started worrying that their hair didn't look good? So you couldn't say anything about clothes, about hair, about appearance. There were only, like, very small mirrors, and they were ringed in printed affirmations, like, "I have a beautiful soul." And my daughter Lucy, who is super skeptical, was just like, "What is this? When can I leave?" And there were, like, people with face paint playing bongo drums, and I was, like, laughing and pushing her out of the car, and she's like, "Please let me stay! No!" You know, and they would post pictures of, like, their vegan pot pie, and I'd laugh and, you know, just imagine her complaining. So I took a lot of that kind of hippy-dippiness and put Alice, my human girl, into that school. And then I had this little Bigfoot named Millie, who is tiny. She's teeny tiny. Her fur is the wrong color. And instead of being afraid of humans, all she wants to do is interact with the human world. She's like Ariel. She wants to be part of that world, only no, like, combing with a fork. She doesn't do that. She's obsessed with a television show called The Next Stage, which is basically People Got Talent and American Idol. It's that kind of show. It's a contest. She has a beautiful singing voice, and she wants to sing. And, of course, this is not going to happen. She can't expose this hidden tribe of Bigfoots that, you know, for many, many years has been persecuted by humans, and they live deep in the woods, and nobody knows about them. The one time of the year they're allowed, the little Bigfoot children are allowed to go out into the human world, can anyone guess the one time of year it would be safe for them to do it? Halloween, exactly. So every Halloween, they pick a different town, and they go, and, you know, just in their fur,
And everybody's like, was there some kind of Bigfoot movie that I missed? Like, why are all these kids dressed as Bigfoot showing up? But so that's the only time of year they can do it. Let's see. I was going to read a teeny little bit of this. Okay. Let's see. So, and there's a third character named Jeremy who is a human boy. He lives in this town. He has seen a Bigfoot. Nobody believes him. He sees a Bigfoot running through the woods. He tries to shoot footage with his iPhone. He ends up shooting mostly his feet. It's kind of a disaster. Everybody thinks he's making it up and just trying to get attention. And his dream is to prove that Bigfoots are real. So that is what is going on. And let's see. What should I read? I'll read a little tiny bit about Millie, okay? So this school has just opened. It's across the lake from where the Bigfoots are hiding. And they've been watching this all summer, and now they're having a meeting to decide what to do. And Millie is hiding in a tree, listening to the adults talk. "We all know what's happened," Maximus said in his quiet rumble as the speaking stick flared above his head. "The Nofers have built 12 new buildings, and this morning there was a welcome learners banner hanging from two trees. By the way, the Bigfoots call us Nofers. We're like, we have no fur. And they call themselves the Yair. Bigfoot is like a very derogatory term. They don't like that." Okay. "A school," whispered Aelia. "A school means children. Children are curious. They will be having canoes or those yak boats." "Kayaks," thought Millie and rolled her eyes. "They'll dare each other to come across the lake, or they'll hear us or will see us, and they'll find us." Aelia began twisting her hands in her apron, and Septima was nibbling the fur on her fingers. Millie, meanwhile, was so giddy with delight, it was all she could do to keep from dancing on her branch. A school. Maybe there would be no fur girls her age, and she'd be able to hear them, their conversations, maybe even their music. Maybe someday she could find some sort of disguise or even a potion to make her fur disappear. She'd long suspected there was such a thing to be used in cases where the Yair absolutely had to venture into the no-fur world. She'd figure it out. She'd make her way across the lake. She'd pretend to be a lost camper who'd wandered away from her parents. And she'd meet a girl and make up a friend. And the girl would hear Millie sing and say, "You are amazing," the highest praise a Yair could get, and take Millie to the principal, who would know a producer, and then Millie would be what she'd always wanted to be, where she'd always wanted to be, standing on a stage in a shimmery, silvery dress, holding a microphone, singing, while people listened to her, entranced. So that is Millie, and I'm very excited to discuss this with everybody.
Great, thank you so much. And I am Lauren Rizzuto. I realized I didn't introduce myself, but I have no book. So I teach at Simmons College in the graduate program in children's literature and writing for children. So let's get our questions started. The first one I have has to do with how we think about children's books, middle grade books especially. You know, we tend to think that they should be happy, they should be comforting. You know, we like a good story. But these books, although I would describe them as hopeful, aren't always happy. I think that when I'm reading them, I have questions of social justice, environmental justice, the justice of the foster care system, national justice, war crimes even, and then bullying and the intense despair that someone can feel because she's isolated from her family and different. And I was wondering if each of you could talk about how you communicate these difficult questions to a middle grade audience. What pressures do you feel? What limits or what freedoms do you have when you're writing to this audience about your subject matter?
I'll leap in and start there. I'm grinning as you're talking about this because I think I have not written a book that didn't have some kind of carnage in it. That's not true. There really isn't the last one. The last one is Cozy. There really is not Carnage in Green Glass House.
There's,
yeah. Fair. If you don't like Carnage, but you want to be nice to me and read one of my books, Green Glass House is probably the way to go. But I do think, and there's sort of always a lot of talk in the middle grade community. I mean, I think in kids' books generally, but middle grade is kind of the testing ground for it because, you know, yes, you have Charlotte's Web in there, but you've also got that sort of that area of middle school where, you know, maybe they're not looking for Charlotte's Web, but maybe they're not looking for Hunger Games either. And I don't know about anyone who's sitting here, but middle school was about the worst. It was the worst time I can remember having in my life that didn't involve childbirth contractions. And even that I would revisit before middle school. And so I think that for kids, you know, there's a lot of, it's a time where there's so much flux and they're figuring out where they fit. They're figuring out what home is. And that's actually, I loved that you said that because I think all of these books have something to do with home. I mean, and I think anything that's being written for middle school is always going to have some questions, I think, about who you are and where you fit. Because that's the point at which all of that, who you are, seems to be changing and where you fit is always kind of up in the air. And then there's just the fact that we're in a world where you can't, I mean, I don't think we can pretend anymore that the world is a cozy place. I can't pretend that with my kid who's three. I certainly can't pretend that when I go in and talk to schools. So while there is a lot of beauty in the world, there also are these other things that these kids, I think, are very attuned to. So from my perspective, and particularly with this book, it's one of the reasons I thought the War of 1812 was very relevant. There are a lot of things there that have a lot of parallels to now. There's intense nationalism at a point where our country was 30 years after independence, and a lot of people called that the Second War for Independence. We were trying to figure out what kind of country we were going to be. We were trying to figure out if we were even going to continue to be a country, whether we were going to splinter. New England almost seceded. Like, there were points where there were a lot of these questions of who we were going to be as a country. And then for these kids, questions of who they're going to be when they're faced with very difficult decisions. And they also were at a time where you really couldn't avoid the fact that, you know, this takes place on ships of war for the first, you know, third
they're
of the book.
They're literally at sea.
Really at sea. They're, you know, the kids have gun crews that they're the captains of, basically. So from my perspective, I try not to be sensationalist when I'm writing about tough things. I think they're, you know, I have an obligation not to romanticize the difficulties. And I think, I think that maybe is where the line is for me. I don't ever want to romanticize something very difficult and make it feel glamorous or make it feel like that's the reason I'm writing the book. But I don't want to shy away from it because I want to be truthful to, in some ways, truthful to the history and the experiences, but also truthful to what I think, you know, a lot of kids are
experiencing,
but also, like, the ability to look at different. The great thing about these books, any books, books for middle graders, books for anybody, is it lets you look at these experiences that, in some cases, hopefully you'll never have, and experience them a little bit, be able to see where you would fit, how you would react, wonder how you would address these questions. And so, you know, I think there is absolutely a place for hopeful, cozy books. Every time I still read Winnie the Pooh, I think that's why I had a kid, so I could, like, read picture books in Winnie the Pooh, but, like, but they're also, I don't think my job is to be cozy, sure. But I do think my job is to give hope in the end, hopefully.
Definitely. One interesting choice, too, to set this kind of story with this kind of impulse in the past, in this conflict of 1812. I mean, that was a long time ago. So bringing these sorts of issues to the page in a book set in the past is an interesting choice. But it's also an interesting choice, you know, could you speak a little bit about, you know, how you're negotiating these hard questions in this book? Because you're writing fantasy, you know, how do you do it, Jennifer?
I guess the first thing that I'd point out is that Charlotte's Web starts
Thank
off
you.
With...
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. This is always like, and this is like, thank you for saying that, because that's always the thing. I'm like, when people talk about, like, kids' books should be cozy, I'm like, yeah, like Charlotte's Web, and I'm always waiting for
Where's
something to
be
like,
Where's Papa going with that axe? I don't know.
The first line of the book is, where are you going with that axe, Papa? So, you know.
Yeah. It's the death of a best friend. It's the story.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Kids know the world's a dark place.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And if you read Roald Dahl, it's like, okay, yeah. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, there are four starving senior citizens in a bed. You know, there's not enough food. People are hungry. Charlie is like starving all the time and giving his mother his portion of cabbage. I mean,
to say nothing of the Oompa Loompas.
We'll get to them later. Kids have an exquisite capacity for cruelty. And I think anyone who survived junior high can tell you that. It is not a surprise to any 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 or 12-year-old that the world is brutal, is brutal. And I wanted, in my book, I wanted to hold out some hope. I think I want to do that in all of my adult fiction. I want to do that in my middle grade book. I want to tell misfit kids, girls especially, and especially girls who look different, that they can be the heroes and the heroines of their story, that they have value, that they have a place in the world. And I wrote very deliberately about Alice and about how she looks and about how she feels and about how she's bullied. And what happens in this book, and I don't want to give too much away, but the mean girls at Alice's new school, because even this school has mean girls, play a trick on her. And they convince her to go swimming late at night, and they steal her clothes, and they take her picture, and they post it around the school. They make posters of her and a Bigfoot, and it says, "Separated at birth." Okay? And I wrote this book, and then I don't know how many of you guys were paying attention this summer. There was a story in the news. A Playboy playmate was at the gym, and she snapped a picture of an older woman in the shower and posted it on her Snapchat and said, "If I can't unsee this, neither should you." And thank goodness was roundly criticized. Was banned from the gym, lost her job, ended up in legal trouble, all the things that should happen when you bully someone that way. But it was, I mean, I felt like sort of fiction and real life were braiding right. in this yep. really uncomfortable way, because like, when I'm writing my fiction, I always want things to be larger than life. What's the worst thing that can happen? What's the best thing that could happen? What's the funniest thing this character could say? What's the most unexpected thing this character could do? I thought of just what would be the most shaming thing for a girl of 12 who feels ill at ease in her own skin. And I thought of this terrible, terrible thing. And then I'm like, you know, I'm online and it's happened.
Yeah.
With an adult as the bully.
Yeah. So it's like, I feel exactly. like any world that we could write, any cruelty, any unkindness, it's never going to be worse than what kids are going to know mm-hmm. as their truth.
Sure.
Is my belief, sadly.
And I guess what I'd add to that is I think there are really interesting possibilities for revealing character in these dire situations. So you had a great passage in Left-Handed Fate where Lucy is thinking about how she hates battle, but she loves who she becomes in battle. Mm-hmm. And her senses sharpen and her movement sharpens and she thinks more clearly and there's a kind of efficiency to everything she's experiencing. And I think for all of our characters, these horrible crises that they experience are a way to test them and reveal their true character in the course of the book. So I mean, in all my books, I will throw the worst possible things at my characters because that's how you see who they truly are. Robert McKee, who teaches the story seminar, has this great quote where he said, "Character is revealed through the choices someone makes under pressure." And so the more you ramp up the pressure, I think it's such a great way to understand someone's courage and their moral fiber and the kind of risks they're willing to take or sacrifices they'll make. So in my books, like in The Wolf Keepers, there are terrible things happening to them, but they either rise to the occasion or they don't, and they have a greater self-understanding because of those choices. And I would say the other piece of your question about social justice or environmental justice, I guess when I'm trying to get kids to think about these things, that's always secondary to story for me. I'm never thinking, oh, I want to make this point.
Yeah, sure,
never think that. But as I tell the story, for me, it's not really about giving answers. I try to put the questions out there. I try to portray it realistically. I try to have the kid characters struggle with things, because I think we all do. But often the endings aren't, oh, this is the happy ending they wished for. It's more that the ending is something that they realize, oh, I never thought of this, but I can live with it. So the hope is just sort of woven into their experience of learning to adapt and deal with something.
I think that's a really good point, because I think the other thing about writing for kids is I think they can sniff a mile away when you've got an agenda, when you're, sure. you know, and, yeah. and I mean, there's kids in the audience, but floating around here, like, you do great.
Our guinea pigs.
Our guinea pigs. Like, so you made a really good point there, that I think that does, I would agree for me, it's secondary to story, but that you are also 100% right in that because character is revealed in those situations, the places where there is a moral ambiguity yeah. or, like, a pressure or something where the worst or the best could happen, those moments present themselves as really fascinating story options.
Right.
And so sometimes you get really lucky and, like, it all comes together like that. But, yeah, I think it's kind of like that's this, the moments where you can talk about those things are these places that have a lot of moral ambiguity and stress points and possibilities, and that's why they sometimes come together just right to make good stories. But, yeah, I think it does, I would agree that it...
Well, it sounds like you're all kind of talking about, you know, the pressures you put on your characters and how that kind of, you know, illuminates them even for you,
yeah.
And that you're also kind of mean to them. that's part of the writing process, right? You have to keep things a little unstable in order for people to keep reading and to enjoy writing your own story. I'd like to ask you about setting and how you built the setting around these characters. Did the setting change shape for you? I mean, so yours, Yosemite, for instance, did you find that you were describing it differently as you kept writing about it, or how are you?
The challenge with Yosemite is describing it at all, because it is such a physical, sensory experience that this, and a huge thing with Yosemite for those who have been, how many people have been to Yosemite? Not even that many. Okay, but is the scale of it. And yeah. I found it really hard to describe the scale. And I love my illustrator for this book,
oh,
Alice
yeah,
Reddery.
Great.
But one of the hardest things for when we were going back and forth about illustrations, and I didn't have much role in that, was just like getting her to capture the scale correctly, because it felt too domesticated to me in places. It's just really uh-huh. hard to draw that. I say that was the toughest part, but it was also, I wanted the reader to feel so immersed in that world. Mm-hmm. And I think setting is huge in these books. Like, I thought I was right there at the camp on the lake and the woods. And for you, on the ships, it was so shippy. Everything was so nautical. And it was such a rip-roaring yarn. I think setting is crucial for me in all of my books, because I think it gives you the possibilities for plot. Like, that's really where you come down to. Setting is so important in what these characters can experience and what they're able to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Can we go next?
I needed a forest. You know? And I thought about, you know, when I went to camp as a little girl, where there would be, you know, the camp and the swimming pool and the lake where you'd go canoeing, and then across the lake it would just be forest. It would just be wild, and what was going on in there? Like, anything could be going on in there. So I had a lot of fun describing the forest setting where the Yeir live, and they live in kind of dugout houses, kind of just hidden, mm-hmm. completely hidden, where they can, it's sort of a Rube Goldberg universe where you pull levers and the windows all close and the doors shut up, and it just looks like the forest. I mean, they've really got themselves kind of tucked in there, mm-hmm. which was fun to write about. You know, and then I wrote about a middle school, which is its own special, horrific, horrific setting of, you know, the
mean
kids.
This is a nicer phrasing than I was giving.
Yeah. You know, and Jeremy trying to give his presentation about Bigfoots, and there's girls braiding each other's hair, and the class pet is raising her hand saying, this is the exact same presentation he gave last year, and, you know, Jeremy putting up the slide that says, now with new research, and, you know. Junior high, I mean, I you're right. Like, there is no amount of money in the world that would ever get me to go back to Henry James Junior High in Simsbury, Connecticut. Yeah. Never.
Can you talk about the shippiness of your book?
I have to borrow that. I'm gonna, like, Elise Broach says, awesome in its shippiness. I had two things sort of going on there, because this whole book came about, which I didn't get into, but my husband, who is not present because he has my three-year-old, and my three-year-old threatened, he said he thought the presentation would probably need propellers, and so he had one. Yeah. So they went somewhere else. But he told me that he was reading the Aubrey Maturin and Patrick O'Brien books, which if you haven't read, they are so good. So good. And he said, you should really read these. You'll really like them. And I was like, I have no interest in reading those. I'm not interested in the Napoleonic Wars at all. That's so boring. He's like, all right, fine. And then we went on a drive, and I was driving, and he read, like, because what am I going to do? Like, he just sat there and read the whole thing to me. Mm-hmm. But they're so good. And the way that, like, the ships themselves are these floating worlds, as they had to be, because you'd live on them for 3 to 6 months at a time, depending. Right. They had to be completely self-sufficient. They had this tremendously regimented hierarchy, because otherwise things don't function. They had their own sets of lore. Like, I mean, the superstitions, and you've probably heard things about sailors and their superstitions, but when we launched this book, I made flow charts of, like, what does your albatross mean? And what does your weird light mean? And I ran out of paper. Like, so there's this whole world that is the world of a ship. And it's an extension of the country, and yet not, has to operate on its own, has to be, you know, all of these different things. And it's just this amazing kind of place. But it's a home, but it's a home with a particular use. And so Lucy, one of the things she struggles with is her ship is taken, like, almost immediately. This place, she's grown up. And she has to say to her little brother, Lau, she said, like, he says, but now where will we live? And she's like, a ship's only a home as long as you hold it. Like, it's a weapon. It's an engine of war, and it's only home as long as you hold it. But she says later, she's like, well, I was lying about that. Like, I don't know where we're going to go. And so there's the ship, which I felt very much was, like, sort of its own character. And then there's the city that they go to, the city of Nagspeak. And if anybody here has read Green Glass House, that's the setting of Green Glass House. And it felt very much like a character to me. Sure. I love books in which the settings are characters, because I think then the better you know the city, it's kind of like you throw characters at each other and see what they do. You throw them into bad settings or interesting yes, settings and see what they do. If you know a city, you can manipulate the entire book by throwing a character into a particular place. Yes. Or go somewhere you haven't been before and the entire story changes. Are you traveling above ground or below ground? I can remember times, I've lived in Brooklyn for 15 years now, and I can remember times where I've had to go above ground at a train station that I've passed through 100 times, but I've literally never been above ground there. And if you had stuck me a block from that train station, I'd have wandered around for like a week, but I know exactly how to get home. So cities to me are fascinating places. And Nagspeak, I had been writing about Nagspeak for 8 years before I started writing the books, because I was using it like a sandbox. I wanted to invent a place and just write about a place and not have to tell a story. And so the city was built so this is how Lucy describes it. It's the kind of place where metal moves of its own will, and entire streets sometimes turn up in different places where they were the day before. And Max says, what on earth are you talking about? Because sailors also have a habit of, like, playing tricks on people who are landlubbers. And she says, I'm being very literal. Those are the sorts of things that happen in Nagspeak. And he says, but how? And she says, no one knows. That kind of place, no one knows is the answer to most questions you can ask about it. And so I had a ton of fun writing Nagspeak, but it sort of already existed in my head, and that was one of the really great joys of getting to write that book.
No, that's great.
Send him to a weirdo place.
No. I have just one more question, and then we'll open it up to the audience, so get thinking. I wanted to ask, what was the most challenging thing for you to write in this book?
In the particular book?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I have to think about that.
Or not.
I'm thinking.
Maybe it was very easy?
No. I can go first on that. I would say one of the more challenging things for me about this book was the character of Tyler Briggs, who is a runaway from foster care. Okay. He's a mixed-race child, and that was just how he came to me, and I had sort of no second thought about that. That's who he was. But when I gave drafts of the book to readers, you know, they were like, oh, he's mixed-race from foster care, that's a stereotype, you should switch the race of the two main characters, you should make the zookeeper. And I was like, well, this is who they are. So it was this weird thing for me where race was both completely incidental to the story, and yet fundamental to their experiences. And I was talking about it with some other writers, and I said, I'm just worried that people are that's going to be some kind of barrier to how they experience this character of Tyler Briggs, when to me, I identified with him so much, and he was just so real for who he was. And one of my friends, Bennett Madison, who's another teen author, said, you just have to make him really charismatic. He said, if you make him funny and charismatic, people won't pay any attention to any of that other stuff. And it was very good advice. It's a little hard to go back and say, say, oh, I'm going to make him really charismatic. But it was really good advice to just think about ways in which people would so identify and connect with him personally that some of the other label questions of, like, he's from foster care, he's, you know, whatever it was, would be irrelevant because they would really understand this character at a deeper level. So that was, I would say, one of the bigger challenges.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
I guess for me the challenge was the first part of the book that has specifically to do with the war and explaining why the characters are doing what they're doing and also the shipboard life. Mm. Because if you enjoy that, I think it's great, but if you have trouble with details or, like, I mean, I don't know, I guess there's almost like two separate sections of the book, and one is the war element and the other is like the whimsical city and the quest element. And I've had readers who desperately wanted more of one or the other, but it was hard to sort of have that, the shippy part be the thing at the beginning and not lose people who sure. were really wanting to get to
the others. Yeah. That's interesting. That
and I'm
sense.
Still, you know, I think the jury's still out. Like I have reader, like there's, my husband really hates the fact that there isn't more like ship-to-ship action in it.
Well, have him read those.
He's read them all. He's read that three times. Like,
I think there's plenty of action.
Yeah,
really fun.
He wanted the whole thing to be ship-to-ship anyway. Well, so I think that was.
I want to take a stab at yours, but I don't think it was a problem for you. I would think creating the world of the Yair would have been an enormous challenge. But
it's
I thought
fine
she
line.
Did
like,
it.
Could find
but
with
I
being
thought
like,
you
oh,
did that so
sorry.
Seamlessly. I mean, it was incredible the way they had a different language. Yeah. They had different cultures, different rituals. It was beautifully done. So I don't know that it was a challenge for you at all, but I would have thought that would be the hard thing.
The challenge was pulling it back, because I wanted to just talk endlessly about, you know, their houses and their clothes and do they wear clothes and when do they wear clothes, and like there's this one pair of boots that all the kids share. But I workshopped this book in my daughter Phoebe's classes. She was in a mixed first and second grade class, mm-hmm, and I was working on the book when she was a first grader and when she was a second grader. So I would go in, I would be the guest reader. They were supposed to have a different parent every week, but I would, like, you know, swap with other parents. And like, I'm like, look, this is professional development for me, so you're a lawyer, you just go do law. And there's this little boy named Wiley in Phoebe's class, and Phoebe would say, Wiley is never sitting still during sustained silent reading, you know, and he was a wiggly little guy, and so I would go in, and I'd read passages, and I'd watch Wiley, okay, and as soon as Wiley started, like, fidgeting over the rug, like, you gotta stay on the rug in the class, and as soon as Wiley was off the rug, I'd make a note, and I'd be like, all right, we gotta cut this, because Wiley is not holding still.
And so, was it details then? That
details
when
and
you
description.
Got deeper
and the stuff
into
that you can do with grown-up books, you can have, like, a very dense passage about the fog or the weather or the moon on the water. Kids just want to know what's going to happen next, I think.
Yeah.
Or at least, I feel like maybe my book skews a tiny or a bit younger. These are all middle grade titles, mm-hmm, but I feel like mine is maybe more the 8, 9, 10 end of things. And, like, you know, I don't like the term reluctant reader, because I think it's a question of just finding a book a kid likes.
Yeah.
But I have a brother who's 11, and he likes graphic novels and he likes comic books, and the fact that he loved this book, I'm like, all right, I think I got it right. I think I balanced the description to the action.
Yeah,
but
sure.
That was a hard thing, and that was a new thing for me after 12 adult titles.
You know,
sort of,
absolutely.
How do you write for kids?
Absolutely, and I mean, I can definitely see how all of these things would be super challenging, but, you know, thank you for taking the risk, you know, to make fresh, interesting, challenging, provocative books. That's really, really important. So, what questions do you guys have? Anybody?
How did I put out two books within a month of each other? Because I also have an adult title. It's called Hungry Heart, and it came out Tuesday. Yeah. I did not know how this was going to be. And in fact, my agent, her brilliant idea was to publish them both the same day. She's like, that would be great. You'd get all this publicity. Who's ever done that? And I'm like, there could be a reason that no one's ever done that. It could be that, like, you know, there's a reason that you don't see people attempt this. And I feel like there were pieces of information that I perhaps did not investigate as thoroughly as I should have. Like, when my publisher said, you will be doing school visits, mm-hmm. I stupidly assumed that that meant, oh, I'd be talking to a class, like Phoebe's class. I did not know that I would be thrown into assemblies of, like, 400 kids. No one told me. So, I mean, it's a little whiplashy.
Sure.
It's a little bit, you know, and I got to give it up to you guys. Like, touring for a middle grade book is the hardest work I've ever done in my life. And I've worked on a farm, and I've been a waitress.
Thank you for saying
it. It is the hardest. I mean, and I think this is typical. I did 2 school visits a day and then a bookstore at night, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And after, like, 3 cities of...
And sometimes a dinner. Sometimes a dinner with librarians or teachers in between.
Oh, no. None of that. No. My like, good manners are, like, shot by the end of it. And I mean, and some of the assemblies are terrific, and the kids are lovely, and they've been prepared, and they know who you are, and maybe they've even read the book. And some of them, it's just, like, the teachers are, like, free period, woohoo, and the kids are, like,
can't
who are you
them.
And why are you
well,
talking?
But on the other hand... free period, and they're out of math class or whatever, so usually you can play that for a little time.
But it was tough, but I'm tough and interesting, always interesting. I always say it's you know, it's not a problem, it's an opportunity for growth, so I've been growing a lot.
Other questions?
Yeah.
I don't know if I need a mic or not. Maybe I do. When you're writing these kind of stories, especially having written, you know, an adult mindset, is there a fear that you're not getting that mindset just right for someone who's reading it at that age, you know, that it might not be relevant, that you're not quite in their mind?
Uh-huh. I mean, I think we can,
all
do we all
talk
have
about
kids?
We all have kids.
We all have kids. I'm going to say that The heart and soul of being a novelist is the ability to sort of really put yourself into someone else's mind. And the fact that I had kids who were the right ages, I think, helped me a lot with that. But how about you guys?
I get the question, a corollary to that question is, do you have to dumb down your vocabulary or your language?
Yeah.
People often ask me that, like, well, that must be really hard to have a limited group of words you can use. And I feel like whether it's third person or first person, if you are fully in the head of your character, the language and the relationships and the perspective all comes very naturally. And I think you're absolutely right. It's about, you know, inhabiting that character and that person's world, and that's the heart of fiction, is doing that. I can't think that I've ever really had a problem getting into the kid perspective, because that's just where the character is. But how about you?
So my son is 3. So at the moment, you would think that would help me to write picture books, but they're even harder than anything else we're discussing here. So I think you sort of hit the nail on the head there with, like, I mean, yes, getting into the mind of the character, but also the awareness that there is no element, full stop, there is no element of writing for kids that is about dumbing down or oversimplifying or presenting something in a watered-down way. There is, yes, you make choices about vocabulary, but, like, I mean, if I could tell you some of the vocabulary I have used in some of these books, and there are words there that I did not know before I had to, I mean, like...
I was definitely looking things up.
Yeah, and I will guarantee you there are kids who read these books and have to look things up. There are kids who figure them out in context, but, like, that's not a barrier. That's also sort of an opportunity. But that's, I mean, yes, you don't want to do it so much that takes them out of the book.
That it's a barrier.
Yeah, because it can. Like, but on the other hand, you think of, like, when you're reading a book, there's knowing every single word, and there's knowing not knowing so many that it becomes distracting. And so that's sort of the line. But that's making choices and choosing your points. I mean, I think that. In terms of content, sorry, I keep hitting people. Okay, sorry about that.
Very close.
So, like, but I mean, I think you make choices, but in terms of content, in terms of challenges, in terms of language, in terms of structure, in terms of puzzles and these things, like, there's never a question of dumbing down. It's always a question of, I think, is the story itself relevant? that's where I think, like, sometimes...
And is it true to character?
Is it true to character? Because that's the other thing I think kids can sniff a mile away, is when you're the adult trying to tell them how they should feel and what should be meaningful to them.
And to that point, which I think connects to what you're asking, if you ever find yourself writing as a parent or as a teacher or as the grown-up that you are, it's always a bad sign. Like, as a parent, you would never have thrown Alice in the... Or, I mean, Millie in the lake, not able to swim, or Alice in the lake and then have her clothes stolen. As a parent, you'd be like, oh, no, I can't put that in. But that's not who you are as the writer, that's not true to the characters.
It's also very interesting because I think that all of us parent our children, but I think all of us also are reporters a little bit. We're noticing what they do and how they interact and how they behave and eavesdropping on their conversations and sort of, you know, understanding them as our children who we love very much, but also as individuals functioning in a society that we've left.
Right, you know, right.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
It's a little anthropology, you know.
Any other questions?
Anybody? I have a question about the kinds of research you do or how you approach doing research for your books, particularly for like a specific setting or a specific historical event or something like that. How do you go about doing research and not be completely overwhelmed?
And not become overwhelmed, did you say? It's such a great question. I love research because I came from a history background and I did research for my PhD. I mean, it was just a huge part of my life. And to me, it is the great thing I can do when I get stuck writing.
I just balance it so much
with the writing because I love writing, but there are times when I get to a point in the plot or the story and I just don't know where to go next, and research is always my savior. And you'll come up with these interesting details or interesting possibilities you hadn't thought of, and it's almost always through research. But to the second part of your question, the overwhelming part, you have to be really careful that you're not writing to show everything you learned, because that is just a death knell. And I think people who do historical fiction, and not Kate, because she did a wonderful job, but if you write from history, there's such a temptation to throw in all these cool details, and they may be irrelevant to the story. They're certainly distracting to the reader, and they will often slow things down. Yeah. So it's a first draft problem. I mean, in the second draft, you have to take stuff out. But I'm a huge believer in research, even in things that you wouldn't think were based on any research. It can be a great way to just figure out plot possibilities. And you know, John Muir's Lost Cabin, I knew I wanted to do something with John Muir, but the day I read about the Lost Cabin, I was like, this is my aha moment. This will be a great way to focus the mystery. Mm-hmm. So I think research is really important.
Yeah. I get nerdy about research, like, really. I mean, and I'm a book hoarder, too, so, like, I hunt down all these weirdo archive books on how to get past a blockade. I mean, that's out there if you need that. It's called Splintering the Wooden Wall. No big deal, but you can find it used here and there. So I get these books and I figure out what things I need to know, and unfortunately, although I keep telling myself I'm not going to do this anymore, like, it's, I'll find a book and be like, I might be able to use that. I don't know when. Five books down the line, I have no idea. And then, so my office is like piles of books stacked this high, organized by what project they were, and like sticky taped. I think that making the choice about what you use and what you don't, that's one of the hardest things for me. But I think there is an element of, you have to know it all. The reader's not going to, and they're not going to know, but you have to know it all, because, or at least you have to know all that stuff, because you got to know what you're going to need to draw from, and you have to be able to answer all those questions. But 10% of it is going to make it in. And the other thing, too, is absolutely, and a thing I believe wholeheartedly, if you don't know where you need to go next or you have a story problem, research is going to be the thing that solves it. Because, and even with writers, like, even with the writer's block and whatever, like, it means there's something you don't know, and you just don't know what that is, whether it's a character thing or whether it's, and so being able to really love finding that weird oddball stuff will save a story, I think, like, or if there's something that's just not working. So, yeah, I'm passionate about it.
Did you have to do much research?
Well, it was interesting. The thing that I thought a lot about, because I had to basically, like, invent a mythology for the Bigfoots, for the air. And what I researched was passing. People who passed racially in the 1800s and the 1900s. Women who passed as men in wartime as soldiers. I was interested in how the Bigfoot sort of coexisted with the humans and how they could sort of sneak their way, some of them, and right? So I had this whole, you know, I read a lot about, you know, different stories, different cities, different times, and then I sort of figured out, okay, what's the story of the year? And then I had, like, all of this information, and it was like, well, how do I communicate this to my audience without just doing the whole information drop that we've all seen in historical fiction, where the author is like, look at everything I took the time to find out, you know, I suffered, and darn it, you are going to, you know, and so what I did was I had Jeremy give this school report, where it was like, okay, this is how I'm going to communicate the information. I'm going to have a kid give a report to a class on what he knows about the Bigfoot. Now, obviously, I know more than he does, but, you know, for my audience, that was how I was going to tell the story, is have him tell the story of, like, this is the town that I live in, and there have been these myths and legends for generations and generations, and there, you know, there have been these characters and these sightings and these newspaper stories, but, you know, it was, like you said, a lot of choices and a lot of first draft stuff.
Yeah. Sure, right. Yeah. Sure.
Well, there's a quick parallel there, too, I think, like, the research with the time period and things, but also with world building, which was another thing, and something that I suspect also took a lot, because there's with their society, there's the choice of what you share and what you don't, and how it comes out. And that was something I thought was really beautifully done in this book. Was like the way that you get these hints and these moments dropped in, sometimes just entirely offhanded, as if it's just not even revealing anything, just happening to mention that, like. But I think that's also a challenge with world building and with setting, is figuring out when to reveal it and when not to.
But I think that struck me about that book in particular. Plays a great role in giving you, like, a confident voice, a confident narrative voice. So the thing I noticed about both of your books is that it's just a sweeping narrative. There's just, it doesn't ever break stride. And the whole thing about snackle instead of snack, or the little special language they use, or the myths about Santa Claus, or the fairy tooth, or the things that their whole, the years. Whole worldview is so seamlessly constructed, and I think it's largely due to all the work you do behind the scenes to make yourself feel very certain of your setting and your community and your characters and all that.
All three of these books are beautifully constructed. They show that the authors have done a tremendous amount of work, but they make it look easy. Thank you so much for this wonderful panel. I hate to cut it short. We have book signing out there, as well as book buying opportunities. So please visit these wonderful authors, and let's give them a round of applause.